Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
You got a timer on me?
Recording.
Huh?
It's recording. Ignore it.
It's going to ding and everything?
Well, yeah,
all
yeah,
right.
Until you shut
I know
up.
You. Yeah, okay. Right. Okay, I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic. Forgive me for chewing gum. I got a sore throat, so try not to make too many chompy noises. My sobriety date is November 28th, 1988, and I got sober at the Clarkston Group. Thank you, Patrick. Where'd you go? He's like, good job. Good job. Your first, yeah. Yeah, I was, but, you know, you got up here and told your birthday. That ain't going to happen here. Yeah. That's okay. One of the benefits of being sober is that, you know, my big thing this last week, I got to sign up for Medicare. I didn't think I was going to live till I was 40, and that is honest to God truth. So, thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Cleve said to tell about all the drunk stuff, so I'll go ahead and do that. I didn't get sober until I was 39, so there's a lot of drunk stuff I could talk about. But I grew up in the Chicagoland area in the Midwest. Yeah, got a few people. Yeah, the Bears, Green Bay. Yeah. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I mean, I guess so many of us do. My father was definitely an alcoholic, and he was a beer drinker, and he was not a daily drinker. He was a weekend kind of drinker, and I can remember beer cans lined up on the sink, you know, back when they used that church key thing. And as a little kid, I used to, there was a couple of drops in them, I drank it. I mean, I couldn't have been any more than 5 or 6 years old. What, you know, what is that? But I found out after I got sober and had some conversations that all the people that died of various things in my family, young, oh, well, yeah, they drank. So, you know, my one grandfather died of a goiter and turned out he really died of alcoholism. And my father's biological father evidently was killed in a barroom brawl. But we didn't talk about that when I was a kid. So I come from a long line of alcoholics, and I come by it honestly. My childhood, yeah, you know, I used to, like, get involved in all kinds of psychologicals about why I drank because of my childhood, and I kind of learned that that was a lot of hooey because a lot of people have the same kind of childhood don't end up drunks. And but I did grow up in with the alcoholism swirling and twirling around me, and I remember the number one emotion when I was a kid was I was scared. And I just remember being scared as a kid. I mean, I was one of those kids that was really good in school, and I got straight A's, and I was never good enough, never did enough. I don't know if that pressure came internally as part of my disease or if it came externally, but that's kind of the way I thought, and I can get right into that mode today. I don't watch out for it. You know, more is better, by God. More is always better. I didn't really start drinking probably until the late teens. I moved out of my parents' house when I was 18. I was raised by Depression-era parents. My parents went through the Depression, the Great Depression. And they didn't believe in kids hanging around, you know. Yeah, I mean, the phenomenon today, you know, if you're 40, you move back in with mom and dad, not in my generation. You know, 18, you need to figure it out. And I did go to school. I did go to school for a while, and I essentially dropped out of college and came back to my hometown, but I did not move back in with my parents. But, you know, I did learn somewhere in there. I guess I thought it was just kind of sophisticated. I started smoking and drinking martinis, I thought, I never drank, you know, like Roman Coke or whatever that stuff is that you dilute the booze. I drank martinis and I drank alcohol, and I never was a beer drinker all that much. I mean, only, I just couldn't figure out beer drinkers, because all you did was you had to go to the bathroom a lot, and it just, what is the point? So I started out basically just drinking hard alcohol. Back in, I don't know, about 1973, you know, it was, I don't really romance the, you know, a lot of people, I had a lot of good times drinking, I guess I did, I don't remember those, and I guess that's fortunate that I don't remember an awful lot of good time drinking. Basically, in 1973, alcoholically, a friend of mine and I, we decided we were either going to go to Denver or we were going to go to Atlanta. Atlanta won. And once again, part of the alcoholism was I just decided I liked the city, and it really is a beautiful city. Back in 1973, there was, you know, you could actually drive on 285, and it was out in the country, and it was really pretty. And I moved down here, quit my job. I'm an insurance broker by profession. Started out after I got out of school, I kind of fell into that, and came down here and got a job and just kind of lived the high life. My drinking was kind of in check, kind of in the party. I can look back now and know that I was an alcoholic. Probably, I believe I was an alcoholic from birth. You know, there's several thoughts on that, but I just think I was just born that way, because I never did drink like everybody else. I could drink more than anybody else and still be, I was a designated driver, probably, you know, hitting a .20 because I could function. You know, I did have a lot of years there where I did party and didn't get in any trouble other than, you know, the normal, you know, not feeling too great in the morning. And I tended to date bartenders, because that's the kind of guys I was meeting, and that's where I was going. And they had a profession I was interested in, so whatever. I probably, you know, I got married for the first time when I married for all the wrong reasons, which I didn't really figure out until I did one of those fourth and fifth step things. But I married a guy who had been divorced and only knew him 5 months, and he was extremely good looking. Anyway, I got married to him. And he drank a lot, and I drank a lot, and it just kind of escalated. And I think he was selling some other substances on the side, and that was not something I approved of. But anyway, it was extremely dysfunctional relationship, and I had a couple children in that marriage, and which is what we do, right? You know, it'll get better. Have a kid. Oh, you know, have another one. Why not? You know, more is better. Once again, but that we drank a lot. We partied a lot. Had a couple kids. He had trouble keeping a job. I, you know, continued in the insurance career, and anyway, it all came to a screeching halt. Around 1981. He wasn't the dreamboat that I thought he was. He got another woman pregnant when I was pregnant with my second one, and I didn't quite know about that until it was too late. And that was the big trigger. I mean, that devastated me. So we got divorced, and he chose to not pay child support. It's a real sob story, but I never got any support from him. But at that point, that was the trigger for the alcoholism to really take off and fly. I'm being the perfectionist kind of personality that I have. I wanted the marriage to work. He was a mess. I mean, I was a mess, but I ended up going to see a psychiatrist because of, I went into a very, very deep depression after that. You know, combination of childbirth plus him not being the greatest husband. And I ended up going to see a psychiatrist. And while all this was kind of going on, I got another job, and I was starting to relieve the tension and the depression with bottles of wine. I had kind of like, I was a mom now, so, you know, you can't go to bars, and, you know, this is the way my brain worked. At that point in time, I did get back, somehow figured out how to get back to the bars, but I was trying very hard to be a mom and a working person and be perfect at everything, and it just didn't work very well. So I would relieve all this pain and tension and depression with the alcohol. And like I always did, but it was not for fun times or partying or meeting people. It was basically to really change the way I felt. And so I started about a seven year downward spiral of really serious alcoholic drinking. And I did a real good job of hiding it from everyone. I lived in Georgia away from my family. I had a full-time career, and I had actually a career that was really budding and really doing very, very well. And I had an expense account, an American Express card, and I was entertaining people. And I basically stayed drunk on the company, which is, you could do that in the 1980s. And then I don't think it happens quite so much anymore because of the way the tax laws changed, because they don't let you do too much of that as a write-off. But back then it was all write-off, so Katie barred the door. I found a daycare center, which became one of my biggest enablers, I think. It was a 24-hour daycare center. And parked my kids there, and I didn't really have a deadline to go get them. So, you know, you just kind of, at 1 or 2 in the morning, you go and pick up your poor kids, and at least they were in a safe place. That's all I can say. But I put up this kind of facade of being, a professional person, and I was drinking like a fish and just really not doing very well at all. I would go home at night, and I don't know how I did it, but I would get up in the morning and take those kids to daycare and then go to work and somehow put on makeup in the car and do my job sort of kinda and entertain people and come on home, and then, but eventually that ended up where I was just avoiding life altogether. I would just go to the bars after work and party and party and party and pick up those, as I said, pick up those poor kids about 1 or 2 in the morning. I have a flashback here about something that happened when I was 19. I was just like, okay, Cleve, this is something that happened on the night. Where's Cleve? There he is. Okay. One of the things that happened when I was 19 years old, when I first started drinking, it should have been a clue. I had a blind date. We all know how blind dates go. You know, he was a big guy. But he had a yacht. He had a yacht out on Lake Michigan. I grew up on, you know, in the Chicago area, so we're on Lake Michigan, and he had a yacht, and it was a sailboat yacht, and there was a bunch of us. About 6 of us, I guess, went out there. I think it was the biggest drunk I ever had up until that point. I was in a blackout. I can remember, sort of remember, but going from the yacht to the beach in the fall when it was really cold, so I had a leather coat on. And you had to do that in a dinghy back to the beach. And, you know, beaches are different up on Lake Michigan. They've got a lot of rocks and pebbles and everything. So anyway, I got so drunk on the shore, they told me later I was drinking out of the bottle. And I can remember, the only thing I can remember about getting back to that boat was I kept trying to get in that damn dinghy, and I kept falling out. I kept falling out. I mean, I kept stepping in it, and it would go, and it's like Lake Michigan in the fall, and I guess the water temperature is probably about 50. But somehow, and I don't even remember this, I went from the shoreline to the yacht, and I swam in a leather coat. And like, I guess they hauled me out of the water and everything, and then I just kind of was semi-passed out the rest of the night. But I didn't do that all the time. I mean, it was just one incident from that, you know, like, you should have known that the alcohol was not. But that was one of those, you know, back when if I did something like that, it was like, okay, I'm not going to do that again. That was not good. Because if you swim in a blue leather coat, you will be blue. Blue skin. And it was, took a while for that. It was like this blob of tattoo that finally went away. But getting back to Atlanta, I digress here. I didn't have all that many things going on until I finally started really, really, really daily drinking during that six-year period after my husband skipped out on me and didn't pay any child support. And, you know, you want to talk about going into a massive pity pot. Boy, that is a perfect situation. Perfect, perfect, perfect. And that was, by the way, the last amends I ever made was that fat sucker. I mean, it took a long time to get back to him to fix that deal. But from 1981 to 1988, when I got sober, was pretty horrific. It started out, as I said, you know, playing with the wine and, you know, going out after work with coworkers, and I could drink more than anybody else. And I would go, we had a bar downstairs where I worked in Peachtree Center, and it was a place called O'Henry's, I think, down on the first floor, and that was kind of where we'd go. I mean, you didn't have to drive, you just ride the elevator. And we spent a lot of hours there. And I remember, you know, I'd ask the security guard to take me out there. I'm a big girl, you know, and I remember this one little, poor little person, this poor little lady that was our security guard had to take me back to the, she was supposed to be my protector. Oh my God. But, so I'm getting more and more depressed, and my career is actually taking, I don't know how this happened too, because I'm getting worse and worse and worse with the drinking, and the career is going up, because I was like, you know, stretching out. I don't know, we alcoholics are just, at least I know this one is, it's just incredible the amount of energy and focus that we can put together to keep us going and to keep that addiction going. That addiction, I mean, it's just crafty the way it can keep, I mean, I could roll on 1 or 2 hours of sleep a night. I truly believe I never really slept for about 8 years, a real good night's sleep. But I, in 1983, I had been out drinking. My kids were at this 24-hour daycare center, and it was in Decatur, and I was drunk as a skunk. So it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and for some reason, these people kept, I would show up all the time drunk, and they'd give me my kids. It just blows me away today, but they did. And I come in what I thought was the driveway to the daycare center. Wasn't a driveway. I went over the curb, down the hill, crashed into the daycare center. And, you know, in a 1983 Oldsmobile, which was the quintessential business car of its year. And I did what, you know, and I can vividly remember, I was drunk, and I can vividly remember, here's my car, you know, the rear end of my car is sticking up towards the street, and it's down like this, and I'm put it in reverse and drive out. What the hell? And so I'm gunning that car, and there are azaleas flying all over church. And I'm like, 1 o'clock in the morning, and guess what? They got a little bit scared in the neighborhood with all that noise, and the next thing I know, there are blue lights coming from both directions on Church Street to come and visit with me. And I finally just put it in park and got out and went into the daycare center, and police showed up, and I was arrested in my children's daycare center. Now, that's a great memory. Fortunately, they were sleeping, so they don't have that memory, but I certainly do. I have that memory. That was, and so I had to leave the Oldsmobile, you know, its ass end up towards the street. I'm on my way to the DeKalb County Jail, and whining the whole time, you know, how, I don't know, you know how we talk to cops, poor cops, I mean, you know. I mean, if there's any police officers in this room, you know, bravo to you, because we're really great. I like to watch the TV show Cops, because it takes me back. everybody on that show gets busted because they're drunk or high or, you know, and these poor guys have to deal with it. So here I am, I'm in the back seat, and I'm, you know, handcuffed behind my back, and, you know, and I'm, you know, and I'm in my, I worked in Buckhead, I had my beautiful little gray Buckhead suit on, and you know, they're booking me into the jail. And it freaked me out, of course. And they put the women in this little teeny, at the time, the drunk tank was like 5x7 for the women. The men had this great big, you know, two or three areas where they went, and we were stuck in this little. And I just knew I didn't belong there, because everybody else was a hooker or, you know, something else. And, you know, I didn't belong there, you know. And it was finally my turn, you know, they bond you out, and you get to bond out. And so what do? I never bonded out of jail before, so like an idiot, I had been out drinking with my boss earlier in the evening. So I called my boss, you know, and he actually came down and paid the fine, and it was like early in the morning. And as I walked out of the jail, one of the customers that I had was a limousine service, and my company had actually paid to have a limo pick me up at the jail with a sign. You know how they take, you know, if you're like, yeah, they give you a sign like, Karen. My last name was Parr at the time. Karen Parr. And I was like, oh. They thought that was kind of cute. And I was so embarrassed, I just walked past this poor limo driver. I don't know, he could still be sitting there for all I know. All the other. So anyway, I was this good girl that you know, you don't get arrested if you're a working mom, and you just don't get arrested. It's kind of like a fluke, I guess, I thought it was. But it shattered me to the point, you know, all the ensuing other, you know, I have to go find the car, and then you have to get somebody coming, you know, all that stuff you got to do. And I was, this was before they changed the law in Georgia where you could just go plead a nolo and pay a $250 fine, and it was like not a big deal like it is now. But it devastated me emotionally, because it was not, you know, something wrong. It was kind of like where I, you know, there's something wrong, you don't get busted. You know, normal people don't get arrested and get bailed out and, you know, have all this stuff. So I went to a friend of mine who was in Al-Anon, and go to an Al-Anon, why not? she suggested that I go to AA if I thought that maybe I had a problem with alcohol. So I ended up, I think, going to the Memorial Drive Beginners Meeting, and I went to my first AA meeting, and did not connect at all. I truly did not want to be an alcoholic. I just didn't want to. Even though my alcoholism had taken me down pretty far at that point in time, I wasn't ready. So I went in there, and I can distinctly remember, you know how y'all, and I do it now too, don't drink, come to me, just come back tomorrow. You know, I was a clerk, come back tomorrow, don't drink, and, you know. And my brain said, and I didn't say anything out loud, which I should have, of course, because then somebody could have helped me, but I wasn't going to ask for help. But my brain said, God damn, if I, you know, could not drink and come back tomorrow, I wouldn't be here sitting here anyway. I mean, if I could do that, I wouldn't be at this AA meeting. You people don't get it. And that was kind of my pattern for, drinking was like, I would get in trouble with something. And sometimes it was the police, sometimes it was the work, but I would get in trouble, and I have this kind of little mini epiphany that there's something wrong with you, and it's got something to do with alcohol. So I trotted on back to AA and maybe pick up a white chip, maybe not, but I wouldn't stay. I just didn't. I was looking for how I was not like anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just did not, it was just, for some reason, it was a dirty word to me at the time. And as I know now, I just wasn't ready. I wasn't beat up enough yet. I did that for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. And then second DUI comes around. I was out, and I remember this one was like, cop looked at me like, are you stupid or what? I stopped at a stoplight, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and it just didn't turn green fast enough for me. So I turned left on a red light, and he got me. And I wasn't, you know, didn't do anything spectacular that time. I just did something stupid. And the cop kind of said, it's kind of stupid, but, you know, now I got arrested for DUI. Damn. You know, you probably want to go home. And so off we go to jail again. This time I knew how to do it. I didn't have to call my boss. I whipped out my American Express, called the bail bondsman. And it was like I was an expert in getting out of jail at this point in time. Once again, I just, you know, more and more depression, more and more drinking every day. I drank every day for about a 6-year period. I didn't drink in the morning so much as I had to have a drink at noon. I would always go out on a business lunch at noon and make sure that there was alcohol being served. I always drank at night. By this time, the partying, the going to bars and everything had totally ended. I was imploding. I just wanted to go home and drink behind closed doors. And that's basically what I did at night. And through all this period, I'm still trotting over to, you know, I went to the old Clarkston group when they were in Scottsdale. I think I went there 2 or 3 times, and I would find different places. I didn't want to be in my own neighborhood because I didn't want my neighbors to know. What an idiot. I would take, like, every now and then, I would do a Medlock Park run with wine bottles, and I would have them in this big trash bag. I couldn't leave them out for the garbage man because the garbage man would know I drank. So I would haul them over to Medlock Park and dump them in the, you know, and it was just so nuts. But I did reach a point where it got pretty horrific. I don't want to say I was living kind of like the hoarders people that you see on TV, but my house was really in bad shape. Because I just quit. Nobody came over. I was imploding. I could not function on any level. And I kept doing that for years. I mean, I don't know how I kept my job other than, I think they just, I don't know if he felt sorry for me. I had 2 kids, whatever. But I wasn't even doing my job. We all do the same thing. I mean, I would go to different liquor stores or go to Kroger. I was a wine drinker, so you can go to Kroger's and get that, and then go to Kroger's and plug it. Because, you can't go to the same place every night. I ended up with all that, the paranoia, the fear. Just spiraling downward. I came up with a brilliant idea, even though I was making good money through all of this, that, you know, it had to be the insurance business that was making me drunk. So I owned part of the company at that point in time, and I opted to sell my piece because I was going to get out of the insurance business, and therefore I could quit drinking. And well, it makes perfect sense, right? So I got out in 1988, and went home and didn't have a job and had a whole pile of money. And guess what? I didn't quit drinking. I drank 24 hours a day. And it didn't last very long because I was in pretty bad shape to begin with. Until I crashed. And what got me into these rooms was not all that stuff that I went through. It wasn't the divorce. It wasn't the crappy husband. It wasn't the, you know, the DUIs. It was the fact that I had nothing left, and I can remember it, and I hope I never forget this, drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and not being able to get drunk. I couldn't kill the fear. I couldn't kill the shame. I drank for years towards the end to check out, and damn, I couldn't check out, and it was awful, and I hope I never forget that. So it was to the point of, you know, okay, you either got to kill yourself, which is inconvenient when you got two kids and you don't want, you know, you got, you know, what are you gonna, I got dogs, I got kids, I can't do that, I can't kill myself. So I go back to AA. This time it's different. And I remember I went over to the Clarkston group on Lewis Road, and they had a 10 o'clock meeting, and if you know the Clarkston group, they got 10 and 2 and, you know, 6 and 8 and whatever. So I went to the 10 o'clock meeting, and I was going to go in and pick up a white chip and say something, but obviously I was not crazy enough at that point in time, and I just couldn't do it. So I got in my car, and I went out, and I knew if I went home, I would drink. So I hiked it on out to Stone Mountain Park and just kind of drove around for 3 or 4 hours. I don't remember too much what I did. I don't know why I did that, other than it had to be God keeping me from going home because I would have drank. But I went out to Stone Mountain Park and I went back to the 2 o'clock meeting. And lo and behold, I did go in there and I picked up a white chip. And this time, it was different. I actually asked for help. And when the ladies in the group gave me their phone numbers, I kept them. And I left that day, and I was pretty much told that, same thing I'd been told all along, that, you know, you're going to come here and you're here for an hour, but when you leave is when, you know, the craziness starts, and, you know, at night, and something about nighttime, get a little nutty, and so pick up the phone and call me. I've been hearing that for 6 years, and I thought that was the dumbest thing I ever heard. This time, once again, I think it was a God thing. I did make the decision. Instead of going home and drinking, which at this point in time I knew wasn't going to work anyway, I picked up the phone and called the lady at the Clarkston group, who I still know today, and talked to her for, poor thing, about 4 hours, which I remembered as about 15 minutes, and she continues to tell me, no, it's about 4 hours. You know, she probably was doing dishes and everything. But I actually made it through the night without drinking. And that had not happened in 6 years, except for the time, you know, when you're in jail someday. If you don't have a connection in jail, you know, I wasn't there long enough. But first time in 6 years that I had gone 24 hours without drinking. And I went back the next day, and I had this peace that I knew it was gonna be okay. I didn't know what was wrong with me yet. I knew I was an alcoholic, and it wasn't okay to be an alcoholic yet. But I just had this kind of a, I call it kind of like my mini step too. I mean, I had hope. I knew that AA could help me out. So, you know, then I jumped in. I wasn't working at this point in time, because you will recall I quit my career and pretty much I was unemployable anyway. Nobody would. I lived in I remember it was a salmon colored sweatsuit, because it was about all I could muster up the strength to put on. I know it was about, I was about 5'10", I weighed about 116 pounds, I was in really bad shape, and I didn't realize it. The first lady that sponsored me told me several years later when she saw me, she said, you realize you were orange when you came into, and I didn't remember any of that. I just knew that I just couldn't live like that anymore. And when I figured out that just making a connection with another woman in AA, it was like everything kind of opened up. I mean, I went to meetings. I didn't go to a treatment center, but I went to Clarkston all day, every day, off and on, in and out of that place for probably about a year. I mean, I must have gone to 1,500 meetings in the first year. I mean, I just couldn't do anything. And, I was fortunate enough that I did have enough money out of that company that I could pay my rent and just live at Clarkston. And that's what I did. Part of my story, I mean, that's what happened I know what it was like. I mean, I drank for 39 years. You just got a little bit of it. And I got sober because it just didn't work. I couldn't get drunk. And then 3 weeks after I got into Clarkston, I was still barely, you know, I had to get a sponsor right away, and I was so messed up, and I couldn't, my brain was sparking so bad, I had to make a list of things to do. She had me like, stupid stuff. Brush your teeth, comb your hair, feed the bird, you know, that kind of stuff. Because given all of that in my brain at one time, I couldn't make a decision what to do. It freaked me out. So I had to do that. But at 3 weeks sober, my kids were in a private school. And I had left an AA meeting and I went over to pick them up. And the lady that ran the school met me at the door and said, I got some news for you. And I said, what? DeKalb County came and picked up your children today. This is 3 weeks after I get into AA. And of course that, they had, you know, I guess they weren't, they were behind. So, DFACS, let's hear it for DFACS. DFACS, those poor people were behind in whatever complaints had been made about me, and they finally caught up with it. And so they investigated me and what was going on, and they went and picked up my kids. So here I am. 3 weeks I haven't had a drink, and I'm trying my damnedest to just go to Clarkston all day, every day. And the county has taken my children away. And I think they were about 7 and 8 years old at that point in time. So, I'll never forget. I mean, it was like another big choice. You know, I could go drink, I could go get messed up, or I could go to Clarkston and ask for help. And I just went right over to AA and asked for help. And, I got it. I got all kinds of folks helping me out, recommending a lawyer. And, I'll never forget one of the best pieces of information I got at that time was, if God wants you to have your children back, you'll get them back. But if God wants your children to be in foster care for a while, that's where they're going to be. Didn't like that one, but you know what? I walked into my court. I had hired an attorney. I walked into court 4 days later, and it was explained to the judge that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous and I was doing the best I could, and that I had, you know, A, B, C, D, E lined up, and he gave me my children back under supervision. 4 days. That is incredible to me, that Alcoholics Anonymous carries that much weight within the court system. So that was, you know, devastating at the time, and, you know, talk about two pissed off little boys. They were not happy about all that. Oh, you know, and then part of my story is, you know, being a single mom. Now I'm sober. Now I'm going to be your mother. I hadn't been one for 8 years. And now you have rules, and we're going to, you know, have fun times together. It's like, you know, I don't think so. Kids are like, it's like, what are you, what planet did you fall off of? But eventually it did work out. I mean, we had some rough times getting that relationship, you know, making your living amends to your kids. Just try to be a mom. I was never a mom until, you know, I provided for, but that was about it. I wasn't emotionally there. Couldn't be. Not if you drink all the time. So I got my kids back, and I was under court supervision, I think, for about, I don't know, 6, 8 months. I don't remember. I mean, she never came out to see me. She would call me on the phone. I guess she figured out everything was going to be okay. I eventually went back to that company that I quit and talked to the guy, because I had to go, you know, well, let's get into the steps. I mean, I did work some steps between then and going back to the company. Got a sponsor. I told my story at four months. I was over at Clark's, and I was told, asked to tell my story. And I'll never forget. I mean, I was, you know, on the clock like I am now, which I haven't got a clue what time it was, 8:15. I'll roll it along a little bit. And I was like 1 hour into it, and people are walking out. And I got sober when I was 39. I think I was talking about right about the time where I fell off that boat. I was like 19 years old. I was just telling you everything about my world. And so, you know, given that, you did a great job. So working the steps. So I remember specifically doing it out of the big book. That's the way I sponsor people today. I mean, step three, we went somewhere. We went out Stone Mountain, sponsor and I, and said the prayer and the whole nine yards, just like it says in the book. And then, you know, dove right into step four. And, of course, my first step four was, you know, big yada, yada, yada about, you know, my childhood and all this, you know, other stuff that, you know, you have to get out. I mean, I just think that that's, you can't do it wrong, I don't think, but just get it out. And took my fifth step out in Stone Mountain Park, and my sponsor said, okay, now take that notebook. Because she knew I was going to be doing another one where it was like, you know, you do a real fourth and fifth step. And this one was all the yada yada. And she said, you take that notebook, and we're going to put it in that trash can over there. So I did that. Put it in the trash can, and I swear to God, I think it was about 10 years, I kept waiting for that thing to turn up in the news media somewhere. It's like, oh my God, it was like this, all this sick stuff in there. But we did go back and do a real, you know, let's do the resentments and fears and all that kind of stuff and the way we're supposed to work it. But the big one for me was doing all the amends, and the living amends was for my kids. And I was so isolated. I mean, I didn't have that many people. I just, you know, going through all the resentments and fears and people I owed amends to, there wasn't an awful lot of them when I got down to thinking about it. My family wasn't around it because they were up in Chicago and I was down here. But in the business world, it was pretty bad. I mean, I had specialized in the trucking industry, and there was like 18-wheelers floating around Atlanta with no insurance. I had to make amends on that. Oh, yeah. And I had to go to my boss, my old boss, and, you know, and anyway, the upshot of that was he offered me a job back to run an office in Hilton Head. So I, 1 year sober, you know, I got my life together, and I'm on my way to Hilton Head with two kids to run an office, and that lasted a couple of years. I got hooked up down there, you know, AA, you know, like I was totally entrenched in Alcoholics Anonymous up here, and I go down there and they do it a little bit different, and it was kind of weird. They had like a resentment chip you could get and things like that. They did. It was great. It was great. You know, they'd holler, you know, you want to, anybody got a resentment? Come on up here and get this chip. And then when you want to get rid of your resentment, you give it back to the group. So that was kind of different. I thought it was kind of cool. I lived down there a couple of years and then came back here. And, went back to the Clarkston group when I moved back. I had a period of about 5 months. My kids were doing well. I had very athletic kids, and we were involved in the DeKalb County traveling team for baseball. I got really sick with that. I totally focused on that and traveled, and I didn't go to an AA meeting for about 5 months. I got about 3 years sober. And as I look upon that, that was just God keeping me from drinking, because by the time that 5 months was over, I was on such a dry drunk. I was mad. I didn't like anybody. I was scared. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't going to drink, but I was batshit crazy. And I did go back to Clarkston, and I'm glad that, you know, if you don't drink, you can quickly get back on the track in this program if you just get back into working on the steps. The good stuff about AA is everything that I lost to my drinking, I pretty much got back when I got into AA. That cruddy husband that I split up with, I did make amends to him about, my son wanted to find him. He was having some issues. And I thought, okay, we'll find him in Idaho or something. And, yeah, he was in Idaho. Part of his story was he wanted to be a cowboy, and he wanted me to go live and go be a cowboy, have a life. But I actually talked to that man over the phone. I didn't think I ever would forgive him for what he did, for getting another woman pregnant, and I'm having his kid, and I'm just the guy. And it just came out. I just said, you know, I apologize. You know, my part in all of that was I married somebody I really didn't know. And we had a good time. I'm not crying. He's crying over the phone. And we just let it, I let it go. I don't have any relationship with him now, but I mean, it's one of those things when you make amends, you know, you can walk into the same room. If you can walk in the room with somebody and you got this, oh, I don't want to see that, man. It's time to start looking at that for me. So we got that behind us. But I met a man when I was 7 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have a short story of that. It was we've been married 16 years now, and we've been together 18 years. And he's got about 23 years in the program. We went and climbed up Stone Mountain, got married. we always liked the sunrise service that they had, so we decided to get married, because, you know, alcoholics just do crazy stuff anyway. So we climbed Stone Mountain at sunrise. And we asked a few people from the Tucker Group to come. And the Tucker Group, you know, is not, you know, not a lot of young folks at the Tucker Group. And we thought we would be, probably be up there all by ourselves. And it was amazing. There was about 40 to 50 people climbed the dark, in the dark, to come see us get married on top of Stone Mountain. And that was just a beautiful, beautiful thing. My husband, as an aside, I've been dating this guy, I don't know, a couple years. And, it was his birthday. His birthday's in May, so I'm up there giving him his chip. And sitting in the, you know, before we go up there, just fidgeting and carrying on. And just, what is your problem? You're just getting a chip. Sit still, Ed. You know? And what happened was we got up in front of the group, and he whips out a ring and asks me to marry him in front of the group at Tucker. Yeah. You can't say no to somebody. He knew what he was doing. But, yeah, oh, here's this diamond ring, and, you know, nah, I don't want to marry you. Nah. So, anyway, so that was one of the nice things that came out of AA. I lost my house when I was drinking. I've had several houses since then. My husband and I have purchased houses and rehabbed them and fixed up some nice places. And it's kind of like that karma thing where the house that I left drinking, a drunk house, was, you know, totally, you know, I don't know, they should have bulldozed it, but they didn't. I've bought some of those kind of properties and fixed them. That's just kind of part of sobriety for me. Got my career back. I'm going to be retiring from the insurance business probably in a couple years. And over the last year, I've had two or three jobs in sobriety, but over the last year, my boss came to me and asked me to manage the entire department, which I thought was, God, I'm getting ready to get out of this stuff. I don't want to manage anybody. And I got to thinking, well, maybe I can make a difference, and I decided I would do that. And I can tell you what I find, I hadn't been in management or managing people for several years, and getting back into that in sobriety, I find that I'm, the way I treat people, and it's what you people taught me. And I can't find, you know, our sayings, you know, coming up. Just do it for today. And I got a couple people that work for me that are in recovery. Yeah, Karen, we know. So, yeah, I was in that rehab center. We know what you're talking about. But the point is that sobriety is such a gift from God. I came to AA. My childhood was, we had no religion in my house. My parents were atheists. So I came to AA and you guys tell me about God and I'm like, oh God, no, no. But the good part of that was I came in with a clean slate. I didn't have to unlearn anything. I didn't come in with any predetermined ideas of what God was or higher power was. And today I have a very profound belief that he has taken care of me and he's taken care of all of us. I guess I'm almost done. Service work, sponsorship. I mean, I could talk for hours. Anytime anybody asks me to do something in AA, I will say yes. Unless there's some, can't recall ever saying no. Because my first sponsor said, that's what you do. Service work keeps me sober. Hopefully I've shared something today. I truly believe that somebody in here heard something that I said, maybe that they'll be thinking of 20 years from now. Who knows? But that's what we do. We pass this thing on. You don't keep it to yourself. I've done several service positions. Kicking and screaming every time. And I was so wrong about the kicking and screaming. Every one of those service positions has turned out to be such a blessing in my life. I meet so many of you people. Just like showing up tonight, I didn't even ask. I mean, I thought I was coming over to talk 10, 15 people. Because I didn't ask. Goes back to the getting sober. Ask. oh, my God. Look at here. So it's it, I'm not scared anymore. I was that scared little kid. I was scared for 39 years, except when I was putting alcohol in my body. I'm not scared anymore. And that is incredible. Because that's what my alcoholism is. It's an irrational fear that just gnaws away at me. So I just thank God for that and you people for that. And I think I need to shut up and close it down. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.